Good morning and welcome to Back Chat. I'm Hugh Chiverton.
And I'm Brian Curtis. In today's program, a double header for you. After 9 o'clock, we'll be looking at the budget, asking what we can expect from Henry Tang today, this morning. But first, West Kowloon.
Well, it was a surprise move yesterday when the government said that the shortlisted developers were no longer interested in developing the culture zone. A committee is planned to think about the way forward, but for now, it seems that the project is adrift.
Most legislators welcomed the news, having felt that the administration was pushing the plan in the face of public hostility or indifference. What about you? What do you think? Do you welcome this rethink, or has something somewhere gone very wrong? Give us a call on West Kowloon before 9 o'clock and the budget after the news at 9. 2338-8266 is the phone number and the email address backchat@rthk.org.hk.
And joining us in our central studio for the first part of the discussion, well, in fact, for the whole of the discussion, is David Webb from website.com and Patrick Lauer, legislator, who's chairman of the panel on planning, lands and works. We'll start with you, Mr. Lauer, I think. Good morning to you. Your reaction to what Raphael Hoy had to say yesterday?
Well, you said in the beginning that that's a surprise, you know, but I think that is not a surprise to me, because I think it's important that government look at our subcommittee report and respond to it. I think in this case, the government had indeed, looked at what we have analyzed. It's important that electoral members take into account the public views, and the report is actually an outcome of that, together with our experience in Bilbao. So this together, I think, is an important move by government. In fact, a lot of people criticize that we are delaying the project and all this. I don't think so, because this is the move, that can get government to go ahead. I think this is important. This is another step back of doing the right way of consulting the relevant parties is very important.
Okay, these committees are not going to be... What's the connection with LegCo and these committees? Do you know? Is there any more proof? Is there any proof that they're going to be consulting LegCo more closely in future?
Well, LegCo is always doing their job as a watchdog, But these committees are important to take people that are actually... I feel, if they're appointing people in these consultative committees, they should be the people that are really the users, the people that are going to participate in all the cultural areas... cultural activities in Hong Kong. So these are the people we should consult and really make sure that the provision, in the West Kowloon cultural project is the right thing for us,
In Hong Kong. There are things like, it's so you're happy that it's still going to be a cultural project?
Oh, yes. That is what the five concept we related again, that this is a very important part of a comprehensive development. It's not just a real estate project,
David Webb, let's get your view.
Morning.
Do you welcome the delay and the rethink?
I welcome the rethink. I think the government should have recognized the problems much earlier, and they had plenty of advice on the subject from legislatures and elsewhere. The fundamental issue is that basically what is the culture port follows in the footsteps of the cyber port. It was an attempt to dress up a property development with another label and also to bypass the legislature on approving expenditure on government facilities such as concert venues and museums and so on. And I think the two things should be very separate and should not be bypassed and put off balance sheet. But the government should be honest about it and say some of this land is for residential and commercial development and it will be tendered in the normal manner. And some of this land is for public facilities such as parks and museums and so on, and put those proposals for expenditure on those facilities through the legislature. And if they meet with public support through elected representatives, then fine. And if they don't, then don't do it. Because ultimately, when we talk about the arts and government facilities, we're talking about subsidies, and I think there needs to be very, very strong public support before government spends taxpayers' money on subsidizing an industry which otherwise might not be viable.
Paul Zimmerman joins us on the line. Paul, do you think that in this case it was the public, the developers, or LegCo and special interest groups, or the government that pulled the plug?
I think the it's been the feedback from the public and from Let's Go and from the community as a whole, and the government has taken account of all that input and figured out that it can't work, and it's clearly when they make the changes to the plan that they created a situation where it was no longer viable for the property developers to get involved on the latest terms. So yeah, I think overall it's a good thing that it's being pulled. Now we've got to make sure that we keep the good things that came out of all this hard work that's been put in for the last 7.5 years, and one of them being the appetite for investment in new cultural facilities. The good thing now for this thing is being that it opens up looking at the harbour as a whole and coming up with a plan for where these new facilities can go in the future, and having a close look at the existing infrastructure and the existing land uses, and come up with a better location for each of these facilities. And I think cultural facilities would fit better for Central, and a cruise terminal would fit better in West Kowloon. And these kind of like the musical chairs is now what can truly happen. And as last and probably foremost, the important thing is that this new committee opens up the opportunity for developing a holistic cultural policy, getting input on all the various aspects, including what are the venues that we're going to need in the future. So overall, I think the decision yesterday was smart and the best step forward.
You say it's a step forward. I mean, surely it's a complete... They've thrown away everything. They've thrown away the canopy. They've thrown away hundreds of millions of dollars that the developers have spent, that the government has spent on this whole consultation exercise, and nothing has come out of it. Nothing at all.
Well, I'm sorry to butt in this. Actually, I did ask that question. I think it's very important that the experience gained is not regressive.
Exactly.
I think you have a lot of actually input in this. Well, Rome, it's not built in a day, okay? So let's be realistic, okay? We are talking about a very practical thing here, okay?
Mr. Lau, what have we gained? What have we gained?
Well, we have gained a lot because, look, now, from the very beginning, at the IFP stage, okay, this is, to me, a real mistake, okay? The invitation for proposal is when you ask developers to freely propose the type of density in that particular area. Now, at least in October, government has put in the step that this is going to be 1.18 plot ratio for the whole development. Now, that's a very important step. So that is when you, okay, put down the rules, okay, seriously, and the work that have done in the past is all the experience that you have gained. And I don't think, okay, I ask government whether you can actually use these kind of work. They say, okay, of course, for copyright, you cannot use it directly, but these experience, okay, of course, will be for reference for the future. So it's not totally lost. I'm sorry to say, I think for any planning or development, you have to do it progressively.
But they're not going to build. We've got plans for buildings that aren't going to be built. What's the point of that?
I don't think so. I think they never say that, okay? I think in the five concept, they want to push it ahead right after this consultation, and hopefully a development authority will be established at that time, and we'll take it forward.
If you Google Bilbao, three of the first five choices are the Guggenheim Museum there. Mm-hmm. And what we've done now is we've lost the iconic value of this development. This was meant to be something that would grab worldwide attention.
No, and
We can piecemeal develop it in the old model by using land sales to finance it, but it's not going to be that big iconic development.
Well, I'm glad David actually mentioned the just of our report, okay? But I'm open mind, okay? To deal with this, you still need a PPP approach, okay? You still have public and private participation in the area of the cultural facilities. That is acceptable because you need to think like what the report has said, that you can be more progressive, you can have better ideas, you can have more sensible way of developing this part of the... And because it has to be sustainable. So how you actually maintain these cultural facilities, have good programs, etc., is very important to the success of the project.
But I think your question is right, and your sentiment expressed is correct. I mean, did we lose the iconic value of this proposal? that is exactly what we have won, the fact that you express now that sentiment, and that is exactly what has happened now in Hong Kong. People, the appetite for having iconic developments around the harbour has increased. The appetite for actually government funding new cultural venues has increased. So those are that we have won. Is this the most efficient way of getting there? The last 7.5 years, no, it has been, not been the most efficient way.
But Paul,
that's in the past. We're now moving forward.
But Paul, from concept to conclusion, Bilbao took 6 years. Mm-hmm. We've had 8, and I'll bet you, as my old mom used to say, I'll just bet you a dime, we get another 8 years before we see something there.
It's of course true that this has not been the most efficient process, and the question is, how can we now move forward and become more efficient about how we're going to move forward? I think the fact that the government has come forward and has stepped back from the high, it has stepped down from the high chair and is willing to review it, is actually setting up a commission to look at it. I think all of those, that's very positive news. And that is that would allow, in principle, if they're going to actually now listen and take in good consultation and actually responding to the feedback rather than having this bureaucratic stonewalling of any good input that normally comes out of the public, there is an opportunity for this process to move forward very efficiently now. And the question is, can we make sure that we don't lose that opportunity?
David Webb, because you're an expert on this, you know, this big development was too big for government to handle. They wanted to do it in a single strike, and so they went to this public-private partnership and went with the single developer model and then a modified or dominant developer model. Should the government have taken on the finances on this by itself?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and that was the point I was trying to make earlier, that it's almost unprecedented. I think it is unprecedented to grant 40 hectares of land to one developer or consortium with almost unfettered control over how they mix in what are basically subsidized facilities with profit-making facilities. And that is a cop-out. The government should put all expenditure on public facilities through the proper approval processes in the Legislative Council, and separately should parcel up land into manageable sizes that allows a free and open market in bidding to develop the land for residential and shopping malls and everything else. Because if you simply leave the entire site to one developer's discretion, then you'll get something that looks a lot like the Cyberport, with huge amounts of residential development accounting for 3/4 of its floor area, and then the so-called public infrastructure, which in fact is just office blocks and shopping malls, in the rest of it. There needs to be a conscious decision on the part of elected representatives to spend public money on these facilities, and when they actually sit down and focus on how many billions of dollars they need to spend on it, and also look at it in the round on what existing cultural facilities, museums, venues and so on that we have, then I think much more rational decisions about how much of this we need would be made. And I do think that there should be a statutory body set up to coordinate not just the West Kowloon cultural facilities, but also all of the other museums and venues that we have, so that we look at the overall public involvement in these facilities in one large macro holistic way, and not just look at West Kowloon in isolation.
Patrick, how do you go along with that?
Basically, that's what we have put in our report. Brian, you mentioned about Bilbao, that it took 6 years. Now, the reason is because they had a consultative body to take care of all the views of everybody, and then they have an authority to develop it.
And they use government money.
No. Actually, to tell you, I mean, when we were in Bilbao, the project is not finished yet. The project actually is in stages. They are still building this, okay? They built the iconic structure in order to attract people to come to invest in Bilbao. So we must take it not in context, okay? There is lesson to be learned from Bilbao, but Hong Kong have our own problem. So we should take it as what we see, okay, the importance of this whole area. This is a huge area. And I tell you, this is a very important piece of land. This is a large piece of land around the harbour. We are not going to have any reclamation. So that is a very important area. Now, you did mention about the problem of the canopy and the design of Foster's. Government hasn't said that they're going to give it all up, because design is a continuum. You need to progress as it goes along. Now, my question to them is, now that government has a lot of information, now is the canopy, the cost of the canopy, is it viable, the maintenance of it and all this? Now, because the three developers has made a proposal, so they should know, okay, about all these details, and we would like to know about that too.
Right, joining us on the line now is Democratic legislator Sin Jun Kai. Mr. Sin, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think of what Raphael Hoy said yesterday?
We appreciate the latest move. The government, in a nutshell, is to restart the whole project again. And I think that is what the LegCo has been trying to do to urge the government to have a level playing field of the whole project.
But if you listen to Mr. Lau, when they came out with that second report, and we charged that it was going back to the drawing board, he said no. And yesterday, even the government said that this was not, back to square one, that this project is...
No, it's not square one, then square two, but...
square two, about 1 inch in front of square one.
Yeah, but I think, the government always defends what he says. You know, this is government. But but everybody understand by there's no right now the government cannot choose among one of the three consortium.
So do you believe that the three developers really did back out, or do you think that the government gave them sort of a wink and a nudge and said, we just can't move forward with this, you should pull out?
No. I think the consortium can't come up with a lucrative plan.
I think the government basically, when they recognised how much public opposition to this there was, they put forward a requirement to fund $30 billion of trust fund up front, which any developer, when they get their spreadsheets out, will realise was non-viable. So three of them came to the same conclusion, and everyone effectively has been satisfied, because I think the main reason that they came up with that was not so much in response to public pressure, but objections from all the other smaller developers who felt that handing this project out to a single developer in a beauty parade rather than a proper tender in parcels was not the way to go. So the last proposal the government put forward with this $30 billion funding requirement sabotaged it.
But a beauty parade is what you want, because we're looking for something attractive. We're not looking for a sound business proposition.
You end up with very subjective judgments being made between only three contestants.
It's an iconic building. That's exactly what it is. It's an iconic building, which is supposed to be...
If you look at the scoring criteria for the project, this is why it doesn't work. If you parceled up the development portion of the land and auctioned it to the highest bid, you've got very clear criteria. It's the highest bid that wins. If you come up with a scoring system, which is what they did for this project, and say, 25% of the marks are for artistic merit and 25% for cultural content, then, of course, the government can choose any winner they like, and that's not a good way to conduct public finances.
Well, it's not a good way just to maximise the money. That's not what the West Kowloon is all about.
In terms of the financial portion of that project, it is about maximising finances, and that's why they don't mix properly. That's why the project, as proposed, didn't work, because it was mixing, on the one hand, subsidised public facilities with commercial components on the other hand. And that's why I've said you should have those separated into a statutory body for the cultural facilities and auctioning off the land in manageable portions for the profit-making part of it.
Mm. Okay, we had an email from Benjamin who says the best thing for the government to do with West Kowloon District project is to convert the whole area into a green zone, something similar to a large park, plenty of trees, flowers, vegetation and so on. Such a move would send an unequivocal message to the community that we care about the community, we care about the deteriorating quality of air, we're doing something about it. Stop all this wasteful activity, debating and counter-debating, all this development talk, basically concerned with only one thing, how to make as much money as possible from the project.
We have massive country parks in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
We have so much space that is greenery that is surrounding the city. I mean, this is right in the middle of the city. Mm. We need to have a grassy park right along the waterfront. I mean, some grass, yes, but the whole thing?
Our density of urban parks is much less than almost any other city in the world. When we've talked about this before. It is.
Depends how you define urban. Yeah. If you define the entire 1,000 kilometres as urban, which it basically is, then you're right. We have a huge amount of country parks. Mm-hmm. You just have to get on the MTR and get out to the edge of it before you can reach them.
Well, Patrick Lau?
Yeah, but the project do have a park element, okay? Really, you are talking about very low density now. We're talking about 1.81, okay? The density in Hong Kong as you know, is it 15, you know, 8 and 10, okay, for residential. So as comparison, you will know that the project, we're talking about a relatively low density development. And the park element is in there, okay? You look at the program of this, okay? The park element is very important to integrate with the cultural facilities. So, I mean, people, you know, haven't really understand it. It's hard, okay? It's hard. I don't understand why, okay? It takes so long that still people don't understand what this particular project has achieved. My understanding is people want this, okay? A majority of people in Hong Kong wants this cultural facility. It's a matter of how to do it. Now, if I want to summarize it, you always talk about this 3P thing. I think at least now we're talking, if you look at it positively, okay, if people look at it negatively, I cannot say anything. If you look at it positively, then it's practical. Because look, the developers, the way the government put forward these conditions, cannot actually make it work. So that's why we have to go to the next stage. And then at least, well, the last P I'm saying is progressive. Now we get on with the job, okay? So we get on this consultative committee. We have the three subcommittee to look at the museum venue. We look at the performing arts venue. And then the most important, actually, committee is to look at the financing, okay, and the sustainability of this particular cultural facility. So it's important. It's important to take that step. We'll see at the, in September, come September, okay, what are the conclusions, and then we should criticize government again. Okay, and look at how we can progress, okay, if the authority can be set up.
Do you agree with David Webb that there should be a sharp divide between a statutory body dealing with the performances and the artistic side and the commercial considerations completely separate?
No, this is our suggestion in the electrical report. This makes it clear. Now, to me, I'm open-minded about this. If you have another way of dealing with that better and get the maximum benefit out of the real estate development, in order to fund the cultural facilities, then I can see how it would work. So really, we're talking about ways and methods. Okay, our proposal, LegCo is not a research body. We are not developers. So we just put forward a way that we see the best way. Okay, that we can see at present that can make it work.
Well, I think the government really need to sit down and read again the LegCo report.
It's a
complex system, and I think the government should actually read the report and see if they can, do something along the line proposed by the LegCo report.
You've got to look at the overall impact of this episode on government and governance, because the chief secretary who introduced this was Donald Chang, of course. He was the one who had to support the project for a period before he became chief executive. They've now got to step back and say, you know, are we making decisions in a proper way? Are we ignoring the views of the legislature when we should, in fact, be including them in the governance process? Because it set us back some years, but it's partly because of government intransigence refusing to listen to these views several years ago.
Paul Zimmerman, last word to you.
Well, I think let's hope that the legislators, including Patrick Lau, are going to keep an open mind on where we're going to have the facilities, where we're going to have the green parks, and we're going to have the facilities around the harbour. Now, we're not going to stick to the West Kowloon Cultural District per se, but have this open for people to think what cultural facilities we need and then think about where we best place them rather than think about one location for them.
Well, you're from Designing Hong Kong Harbour District with that overview. Paul Zimmerman, thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Patrick Lau, legislator, the chairman of the panel on planning lands and works. Last, David Webb and Sin Jun Kai to stay on for the rest of the programme. We're going to be talking about the budget primarily after the news at 9 o'clock. Get your questions and comments in. The weather forecast for today, cloudy with some sunny periods and haze, maximum temperature 23 degrees, cloudy with rain, a little cooler in the following few days. 20 degrees at the moment, humidity is at 80%, and the air pollution index forecast for today, medium to high for general, high for roadside.
You're listening to Backchat on Radio 3. Call us on 233-88266 or email backchat@rthk.org.hk. It's your voice.
It is your voice. We'd love to hear from you what you'd like to see in the budget today. Of course, it's too late. Henry won't be listening and he won't make changes as a result. But nonetheless, we'd like to get some thinking on your part as to government finances here. We're joined in the program by Marshall Beyer, Senior Advisor at Ernst & Young, joins us in our studios, as well as David Webb and Sin Chung Kai, who was with us in the first half of the program. So Marshall, since you are the first in, or you are joining us for this half of the program, is there anything dramatic that might happen this morning from Henry Tang?
Well, I think the most dramatic thing is that Henry forgets to wake up this morning and there's no budget speech. Other than that, no. I'm probably expecting less this year. I think the government has got to the stage of managing expectations now, and I think they initially, a couple of months back, were letting the expectations run a bit wild, and I think they've come back online now, and I think most of the commentators you're seeing in media, and even this earlier this morning on your programme, quite clear, very little, maybe a little bit of a tax hand back to so-called middle class, but really nothing like that, because we really don't know which way the economy is going, and we are still really only in a balanced budget. Balanced probably means plus or minus 10 billion. If they get within that range, that's what balance means. And there's no need or desire for any great change.
Okay, that's what you think he will do. What do you think he should do?
Well, what I think he should do is what he should have done some years ago, is push ahead with the goods and services tax. As I'm sure you'll recall, I've been a fan of that for many years now. And I'm still concerned that we have a big structural problem in our budget programme. We are still much too reliant upon the property sector. The cycle has come around again. The property sector did kick back in. And therefore, we've seen the major deficits of 50, 60 billion being reduced now to, say, back to a balanced budget. But I don't think we can rely upon that in the future. And some way of broadening the tax base for a more certain yield for government is essential. Goods and services taxes come as the favourite for that particular...
But Marshall, we save too much here and we don't consume enough. Instead of taxing consumption, why not tax savings? That wouldn't hurt lower income groups. It wouldn't hurt poor people. They don't have much savings.
Another issue, but we have a fundamental problem of our territorial-based taxation, that most of those savings would disappear from Hong Kong if we tried to tax them. So we'd then be in the realms of trying to extend our taxation.
You really think that? I mean, most places tax interest income, don't they? I mean, why would people move?
But they do it on the basis of a residency. So we'd have to change the whole basis of our taxation to taxing residents on their worldwide income. And that's a major shift in our taxation, and it would be detrimental to the attractiveness of Hong Kong as a tax centre that doesn't tax these issues. And I think the whole capital
infrastructure... As would putting in a GST. I mean, that hurts our reputation as a low tax place, doesn't it?
Not really, because GST is...
Because everybody else does.
Correct. There's nowhere in the world that doesn't do it. And if our rate is kept at a low 3%, maybe 5%, it's really not going to have an impact. Again, tourists will not stop coming here because of GST. There's GST across the border in China. There's GST all over Europe, Australia. Most of our Asian neighbours also have a GST. It's simply a question of Hong Kong catching up and creating that solidity in its tax base that is much needed.
All right, David Webb, what do you expect? What do you hope for from the budget?
Well, I don't expect very much. We've been led not to expect very much in the past, and we are facing an election of sorts next year for a new chief executive, so I think he'll probably put this on a relatively low modification, but there are lots of things that they could be doing. For example, we could be taxing people on how much they're paid rather than how they're paid. But at the moment, we have this huge anomaly where housing benefits are only taxed on the basis of 10% of cash income. That's how much they're deemed to be worth. And as a result, if you structure people's packages that way, you could pay them half of their overall pay as a rental allowance, and they'll only be paying a tax on 55% of their income. The biggest beneficiaries of this, of course, are probably civil servants who get a lot of government-supplied housing and pay very little tax on it. And let's not forget that the budget is about two things, revenue and expenditure. On the one hand, revenues are taxes and other sources of government income. But on the expenditure side, it's widely recognised that we have a bloated and overpaid civil service. And we can make the budget more efficient by reducing those costs. Now, part of the costs of the civil service are their housing benefits. So without affecting their rights under the basic law, which they've already been protected by the highest courts here, if we started taxing everybody in Hong Kong on their housing benefits, then the overall net pay of civil servants would come down and the government revenues would go up. And the government could then reduce the actual percentage rates of salaries tax and start to level it out, because although it's sometimes claimed that we have a flat tax, we don't. We have a staggered rate of income taxation, and it would be cleaner if we move towards a flat tax. I disagree on goods and services tax. I think that if it's small enough not for tourists to complain, then it's also going to be administratively expensive to run and collect if we're only charging 2 or 3% on sales. I think that it would be cleaner not to have to introduce a new level of taxation, taxing people twice effectively, first when they earn it and then when they spend it. It's better just to collect the tax at a single point, and that will preserve our competitiveness as a tourism destination. Now, there are things that we could do on some of the things that we do tax. I mean, we have a sort of GST on things like luxury cars and wines and so on. If there's a health reason for taxing something, as there is with cigarettes, to recover the health costs, and if there's believed to be a health risk with alcohol in terms of liver failure and so on, and the health costs that incurs, then fine. But we should be taxing on alcohol content, not on value of wine, which becomes basically an envy tax. Similarly with cars, the road space taken up by a Ferrari is the same road space taken up by a Toyota. So why is it that we charge people more for owning a Ferrari in terms of 100% tax on a large portion of its value? Why don't we just be more rational about our taxation system? So there's a few things that we could be doing.
Have you done the calculation on civil service? Any idea how much money that would save if you adjusted the taxation on housing benefits?
It depends on what you did with the actual rates of income tax. And there obviously, if you brought down percentage rates at the same time as taxing everybody on benefits, then it could be revenue neutral. But it's undoubtedly the case that there are tens and possibly hundreds of billions of value each year which are not taxed because of the provision of housing. I mean, I provide rental allowance to my own assistant just to reduce her tax bill, and I'll continue to do that as long as the system allows me.
Yeah, the system is messy, but I think what we're not getting to is the numbers of yields. None of those issues is really going to yield the government a significant amount of money. Whereas a GST, and again, these are very rough numbers, 6 billion for each percentage point. So if we're talking about a 5%, it's going to give us 30 billion. And it's that sort of number we need to put into our budget in order to have that certainty going forward.
Well, I would prefer to reduce expenditure by 30 billion rather than try and raise more money from taxation. I think we've got a very expensive government sector relative to our economy, considering that we don't have any defence liabilities or foreign affairs expenditure. We ought to be much more efficient in the way the government runs the economy, and it should occupy a much smaller proportion of GDP.
I can't argue with that, but I mean, the government has said it's almost stopped on the spending cuts. The civil service pay is not going to be reduced, and I think it's unrealistic to think that will happen. So I think we need to think of another revenue source. It would be great if we could get the budget down to a mere 100 billion per annum rather than the 250 billion that we're looking at the moment. But I think that's unrealistic.
Well, as I say, I think you can reduce expenditure on the civil service by taxing them on the full value of their compensation.
Do you know how much that would save?
The government has refused to provide figures on that. I have asked. Mm-hmm. That's one area that it can do. The other thing, of course, is that over time, if you simply don't raise absolute compensation in line with inflation, then over time you reduce the real cost of the civil service. So if we accept that they're overpaid by a certain percentage now, we can simply freeze pay for given levels of seniority, and over time that would bring things back into line with the private sector.
Mr. Sin, I saw something in the Hong Kong Economic Journal yesterday from your party saying the government should review the definitions of recurrent revenue and capital revenue. Can you explain the utility of that?
No, I think the journalists phoned me and asked me. In one of the forums, I said, you know, because the government has a very strict definition about the operating surplus or operating deficits, since, you know, the government has the philosophy of matching the recurrent expenditure by recurrent income. But when we're talking about the land proceeds, you know, the income from directly related to land, you know, either by the private equity grant through or by auctions, they appropriate this land to the land fund development of for the use of capital projects. But, you know, my point is, you know, we can look at both. If the government can balance the budget, you know, since the land-related income fluctuates more frequently, but in for example, in the 10-year scales, the average is 20 to 25 billion, which is relatively stable. But, you know, in 1 year, they, because of the, you know, the frozen of land sales, or, you know, that the government income becomes very little. But, while, you know, for a normal year, you know, the government have 20 to 25 billion. If you add up, if you include this as some of the normal income, or, you know, regard it as a recurrent income, then, you know, the government operation surplus or operation account will be operating account will be a balanced budget.
Marshall, what do you think about that? It's simply the way we categorize revenue and expenditure. Could we perhaps do away with the land development premia and simply put in something like a spread out land development tax on the developers? And wouldn't that make the finances look more like an operating surplus rather than an operating deficit?
Well, a land development tax would be an idea. The UK tried that many years ago, but it made great work for the accountants and the lawyers.
Well, you know what I mean, though. Yeah. Perhaps that's not the best way of phrasing it. But instead of having land premiums, to spread the money out over years.
Well, the government does do this, and I'm not quite sure if I understand what Mr. Sin is saying, because we are looking at the consolidated accounts and reserves of the Hong Kong government, and not simply that on general revenue account. General revenue account is the operating in and out profit and loss account. But there are transfers between the various funds, so that in years where, in fact, the land fund yields more, the capital works reserve fund yields more than they're going to be spending, the transfers will come about. So we are looking at a consolidated situation. When I'm looking at the budget, I'm looking at all the profits and losses from all the various funds on a consolidated basis. But putting more tax on land is merely exacerbating the same problem. It's too much reliance. I think the business community, I think the government has concluded that there is a structural problem in that. It's not cyclical, it's structural. So if we add more land taxes, we're simply adding to that structural problem. We've got to address the fact that land will not yield us the revenues that we need forevermore.
I would disagree with that somewhat. The problem that we've got with the land system is the huge upfront premiums that are required in order to gain the rights to develop any site of a reasonable size. And that restricts itself to a small cartel of developers, the top 10 of whom account for about 70 or 80% of all private development in Hong Kong. If we moved to less of an upfront premium and more of either a staggered premium or, if you prefer to call it that, land rental, then the income would be smoother over time and less cyclical, because we wouldn't have these years of, you know, great bounty when we sell off land at high prices, and then years of famine when there's very few land sales or the government suspends them for political reasons to try and prop up the market. And also it would be more efficient, because if less capital was required up front to develop a project, then smaller developers could get in on the act, and margins would come down, and not such a large portion of the development revenues would end up in the hands of the cartel. Moving to a staggered premium system would be more efficient. It would reduce the sort of feudal nature of Hong Kong, where we have these great landlords collecting premiums in the form of the price of apartments from the public and then passing on part of that as land premiums to the government. It's a very feudal system.
And Marshall, if we did that, if we spread that money out, perhaps we wouldn't need a GST, because I don't think in your defense of it you addressed this problem of us not consuming very much. We're very much dependent upon export, re-export, and we're not a consuming place. So we have very, very high savings rates in Hong Kong, don't we? And wouldn't the GST, if anything, hurt consumption?
No, I don't think it would. And again, the experience around the world is it makes that a fallacy. The consumption may take an initial hiccup backwards, but over time, the consumption will still keep up. GST becomes a way of life. It gets absorbed into your structure. So although initially it may give a kick to inflation, inflation is a year-on-year analysis. So the following year it will disappear in that regard. But coming back, that property answer is not right. What you're still saying is, whether it's smoothed out or whether it comes in lumps and chunks, you're still putting the whole reliance on balancing the budget on property.
And why not? The government owns all the land.
No, that's not true. There are other sources of revenue. There's gambling, there's stamp duty, there's...
None of them yield anything like the amount of money that the government needs to run this territory. None of them get...
None of them independently do. Of course, all of them collectively do. That's why the budget is almost in balance this year. And
largely dependent on property.
But if we smoothed out property income by relying less on upfront premiums and more on ground rentals, then we wouldn't be agonising over these fluctuations.
That's effectively what's happened, because the surpluses in one year have been spent subsequently. So the government's smoothing that in that fashion. But it doesn't look very good when you're going from 60 up to 70 down. But that's exactly what the government has been doing. They've been smoothing the property incomes over that period. And that's the government's argument, that they've kept in compliance with our basic law, which calls for a balanced budget, because they can say over a period of time.
They have, but only by engineering a roller coaster in capital values. And that's been the price of it. Periods of negative equity and distress for large numbers of people.
Yes.
Followed by periods of almost hysteria with the profits they've been making recently on
And if
funds.
The government can continue to do that, then our problem is not structural, it's cyclical, and it will continue. But I don't believe that is the case.
Okay, let's.
Well, we are actually discussing something the government won't consider in a short period of time. But I think about on concerning the GST, you know, for those people, you know, who support the GST, I would like to urge him to consider one thing. David Webb, you know, and many others said we want to contain the government expenses. We want to, you know, restrict the government to expand their sizes. If this is the line of thinking, why we need to allow the government to have an additional source of income? And you know, when the government have additional source of income, that is a very temptation for the government to expand, to hire more staff, to expand more, you know, a necessary way of doing things.
Well, for one thing, you'd need a huge department to oversee it, the Goods and Services Tax Department, to actually go out and collect this money from tens of thousands of retailers.
No, that's what the consultation process that's going to start today, I believe, with Henry, will be designing that exact tax. How many retailers will be involved, what the thresholds will be, what the goods will be taxed, which goods will be exempted. And it's not an additional revenue. It's a replacement for something that isn't going to be there in the future.
And that's probably why, since it looks like we're moving towards that, that's probably why we won't see a reduction in taxes in this budget, because if that comes in about 3 years, that's the time that it probably is going to reduce the salaries tax.
We had an email from Tony who asks why the insistence, presumably by those earning decent money, that their tax burden be reduced. What about those like the elderly who've had their CSSD cut and whose fruit allowance has remained static for years? It comes from Tony Sin Jun Kai.
Well, I don't think this is this is contradictory. We can actually do both, to have some concession for the taxpayers, a moderate tax cut. I would say, I would emphasize moderate tax cut, and also, you know, the government has the sufficient surplus to revert the CSSA back to the level which before they were cut, before the CSA was reduced, and also have enhancement program for elderly and also the grassroots people. You know, when we add up these expenses, it is only within the affordability of the government in the latest budget. Well, people are suggesting the range of surplus could be around 10 billion to 20 billion. A mild moderate tax cut means, you know, 5 billion. The LegCo has a consensus, I would say, to bring the tax level back to the year 2002 and 2003. That will only cost the government 5 billion. So we have another 5 billion to 10 billion to take care of the grassroots.
And what about for some of the modest tax concessions for the middle class? Would one of them being to extend mortgage interest deductions? And let me just put this question out. Why not make it permanent?
Well, it is a matter of priorities. I would say, the first power, I would support the first priority to bring the tax cut level back to the direct tax level back to year 2002 and 2003. That is the very first priorities. And anything other than that will be a bonus. So, you know, if can we make the mortgage-related tax exemption permanent? Yes, but that will cost, $1 billion at least annually.
Yeah, it is a question of priorities, and I think, Mr. McMaster, I think those issues are mutually exclusive. We cannot spend the same dollar twice. The dollar has to either go back to the salaries taxpayer or it goes to increasing CSSA. Now, if you're trying to take that dollar and split it 50 cents, 50 cents, that's almost like a judgment of Solomon, to give a little bit here and a little bit there. And that's what the government have consistently done, is tinkered around the edges without making any real significant or effective change on anything. So, you know, that dollar can only be spent once.
Why do you want a significant effective change? Because we've got a structural problem.
Because we've got a structural problem. Something needs to be done to make sure we've got the certainty so we can sit here next year and say, right, we've got $30 billion in the kitty. What do we do with that?
Does GST really give you that certainty?
It sounds like moral hazard to me. I don't think any government should have $30 billion in the kitty to spend as it likes. It should justify every dollar it spends for public money.
That's where Mr. Sin and his colleagues at LegCo are on the spot, to make sure the government doesn't spend it. But then we can think about giving the poor more CSSA. We can think about cutting salary tax significantly, not just back to 15%, but back to 10%. And then we really create an environment in Hong Kong where the salaries are taxed at a very low rate. Because remember, in Europe, in Eastern Europe, we're looking at 10% rates now. Yeah. Hong Kong's historical 15% used to look very good when taxes were at 40 to 50%. But now in Ireland, Eastern Europe, we've got 10% rates. It's not that low anymore.
Well, I think I support the notion that we should move to a flat rate of taxation, and that if we taxed all benefits on their full value, we could reduce that rate probably to 10% or less. I don't think
Amon Shabazz was saying a flat rate, was he? Were you?
That would be one aspect. I mean, David makes the point that Hong Kong is being credited for having a flat rate. We don't. But I think we could get to that, yes, quite easily.
Yeah, you could level it out at
David,
at a flat rate.
If you take that somebody around 20,000, 30,000, those are the people, 30,000, 40,000, those are the people who are paying the taxes now, right? If you're less than 10,000 a month, you don't really pay any tax. So if you sock them again with taxing them more on maybe a housing allowance they get of 10,000, doesn't that double up the burden on the middle class?
That's why you can afford to cut the actual rates of taxation. There's a system of personal allowances.
Does it make it just more sort of revenue neutral then?
Initially, when you're trying to balance the budget, all you can do is be revenue neutral. But we would get some uplift because of the taxation of the benefits on the civil service, which would reduce the effective amount we spend on them.
But those are the people who are paying the taxes now, right?
Yeah, but we should strive to have a system of tax which collects money once in the most efficient way from people, which is the salaries tax system, and not twice when they spend it again through tens of thousands of retailers who have to fill in tax returns. We have to have then a huge department to oversee that and a huge army of private sector accountants.
And yet they do that everywhere else.
To argue about it.
But
they do it everywhere else. They do it, I think, very inefficiently. And, you end up with large numbers of people employed by the government and by the private sector to argue about the exact amount of GST on each retailer. It would be better simply to tax incomes rather than to tax incomes and expenditures of individuals.
But it doesn't seem to me that would broaden the tax band at all. It just means that me, as a middle-class guy, would look different on paper how I pay it, but I'm still paying it.
I think it is important to bring more people into the taxation system because they'll have a greater sense of responsibility then when we have full democracy. Yeah. At the moment, only about one-third of the working public pays any tax at all.
Can I get 30 seconds there? That's exactly the point. More responsibility, bringing them in. But the issue is, if we bring in more people into the salaries tax net, David's exactly exacerbated the compliance and administrative issue. It's a bigger cost for the government to administer salaries tax and collecting $20 here and $30 there under salaries tax than it would be for a goods and services tax.
You can move to a pay-as-you-go system because we're talking about a large number of people in low-paid jobs who currently don't have any tax.
Pay-as-you-earn is a major administrative burden in the UK.
I would like to say I couldn't accept to tax the people more.
Okay, well, anyway,
that's a great point to finish on.
We can close that.
We're out of time.
Another argument for another day. I'm sure that GST, if some kind of consultation is mentioned by Henry Tang in his budget, which begins just in an hour and a half, we will be back on that topic. In the meantime, thank you very much indeed to Legislator Sin Jun Kai from the Democratic Party, to David Webb from website.com, that's W-E-B-B, and Marshall Byers, Senior Advisor with Ernst & Young, and to our guests in the first part of the programme, and everyone who called and emailed us today. Leaving you with the weather forecast: cloudy with sunny periods and some haze. Maximum temperature about 23 degrees today.